With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going. You're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week, and in this episode, I'm speaking to Toby Jenner. Toby's the global CEO at Wavemaker, which, as you might know, is part of WPP. We talk about everything from how Toby got into advertising in the first place. It's a proper old-school story. I really loved it. Also, Mark Reed is a leader at WPP. The state of the macroeconomy and what Toby's seeing from clients in terms of how they're responding. Agency growth and the remarkable agency resilience in spite of the fact that many people predicted their demise. The agency relationship with technology companies, of course, always a healthy tension there, I think. And we also discuss the rivalry between our respective football clubs, probably a little bit too much, but for international listeners who aren't familiar with the Manchester United-Liverpool rivalry, you might learn something about that, I suppose, here. We also have a few events coming up on the Video Week side of things. We've got Video Week Horizons. That's a half-day event focusing on sustainability. That's in London at the Wellcome Collection on February 23rd. If sustainability isn't high up your agenda, I strongly recommend you wake up to what's happening in the industry. There is an ESG tidal wave coming for us all, and you need to have your house in order if you're going to stay in business effectively. It really is a lot bigger than some people think. Then we also have New Video Frontiers, our flagship event that's coming up on March 22nd to 23rd. Day one is going to be a leadership day. That's at BAFTA. And that's going to be a more limited group of about 200 people thereabouts. More discussion focused on the first day. And then the main conference, which people are, I think many people are familiar with, will be on March 23rd at King's Place. We've got two stages there. Then we also have a guide coming up looking at the free ad-supported television ecosystem. That's better known as FAST. We want to produce a guide that maps out the ecosystem, the different companies taking part in it, what's available to advertisers and agencies, and to look at some of the companies who are enabling all of this growth to happen. So if that sounds like something your company should be involved with, simply drop us a note on the Video Week website. Right, now I'll pass over to my chat with Toby, and I hope you enjoy. So, Toby, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Vincent. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it. Looking forward to the chat.
Great. So, one of the things I'm always curious about with people is, like, how did they end up in this industry? You know, a lot of people, there certainly are people who sort of set out and wants to be a marketer or whatever else, but a lot of us sort of fell into it in different ways. So, how did you end up coming to, end up in the agency?
I was probably the former. I kind of looked at my mother, who was a social worker, and my father, who worked in advertising, and thought, which one would I prefer to get into? And for me, I think advertising had more allure. I probably would have done a lot more good in social work. But I thought naively that he might help me get a gig. And his help was hurling campaign at me and saying to write to the top 200 agencies in campaign to get a job. And in those days, for the younger listeners, there was no laptops. It was typed letters. So I had to type 200 letters. I think I got to about 100. I don't think I went for the full list of 200 in the agency school report. And I think I got about 3 or 4 replies, which has stuck with me forever. I ended up getting a job at ITV, at Granada Television. So that was my routine. So I would say perseverance, is how I ended up in advertising. And then after about 18 months, I moved across to Grey, which in those days was a full service agency. So yeah, that was my route in. Didn't quite get the, I remember BBH said, they responded and said no. But in reality, I think of 100 letters, I literally got about 3 or 4 responses. So notes to self, when someone writes or, you know, links in with you or asks for a piece of advice, always try and make the time to help them, because it certainly was noted when I was starting out.
It's such a rare thing. I think nowadays with online applications, I noticed that we'll have, you know, hundreds of applications sometimes for jobs where people are just chucking up a CV, not really putting any thought into it. But I'd be so much more impressed by somebody proactively approaching me for, you know, something when we're not advertising a job. And so, yeah, doing that, showing a bit of initiative, bit of grit. But yeah, it looks like we sort of staged that in terms of you doing all those letters. That's an epic story.
Well, it's true. I mean, it's true. But I think the point, though, I just pick up on that. I think, you know, there's so much competition in every walk of life. You know, how do you set yourself apart from everyone else? So to your point, you know, having something that's tailored and proactive, I think absolutely needs to, you know, come to the fore.
Yeah, it's incredibly rare nowadays. I think online convenience has just done away with a lot of that, but there's still a huge gap for the young people listening. It's a good move. You're going to get inundated with letters now, Toby.
I know. Careful what you wish for.
You said, absolutely. Yeah. Anyway, so how has agency life changed over the course of your career? You know, since that sort of first job at Grey, well, I know you sort of started at ITV, but, you know, in terms of agencies, how has it changed?
Well, in some ways, it hasn't. And in some ways, it's changed immeasurably. So, you know, what hasn't changed is the core purpose of our industry, which is to grow brands and businesses through the investments that they make with us. How we do it, I suppose, is what's changed. You know, the proliferation of media, of digital, of programmatic, of data, of analytics, you know, that aspect of being able to measure more than ever the impact that the investment is making is what's really changed. You know, if I look back, you know, we would invest pounds, dollars, whatever currency into the market on behalf of a client, and they would, you know, ultimately see some impact, but the being able to tie it together with that investment was very much more difficult to do than nowadays, where A, it's in real time, you know, rather than tracking, you know, various bits of data that were, you know, months behind. So real time. And as I say, you know, the fact that we're now so digital as a industry, it really does allow us to measure the outcomes more than we've ever done before. I think when I first started, media and creative were within one business more than not. There were a few media independents, but the vast majority of media was from a full service agency. And that's obviously, I would say, almost come full circle whilst we're not now part of the same agency per se. We are absolutely more integrated than ever before, particularly at WPP. So, yeah, that's kind of come full circle. I think culturally it's changed beyond all recognition. You know, when I first started, I think there was much more of a lunching and a drinking culture, and that I think has changed beyond all recognition.
But that changed for the better or the worse?
Well, no, occasionally I'd like to go and have a good lunch. No, I think for the better. I think it's a much more professional industry, and rightly so. You know, we're investing billions of dollars on behalf of our clients, and I think it's the professionalism of the industry would be the big change over the last 30 years or so that I've witnessed. Gosh, long time. So those would be some of the things. I think, you know, as I say, it's made it much more inclusive as a culture, you know, much more much more able to have a varied mix of individuals within the industry and people being able to feel themselves rather than maybe having to feel as though they had to be part of something they didn't really want to be. So I think no, I think the industry is a much better and more more inclusive business now than ever before.
We'll move on to the more commercial business stuff in a minute, but just one last semi sort of philosophical question. But if you go back to, you know, your younger self, that kid sending out the 200 letters, what would be your advice to your younger self if you were sort of wanted to push him forward?
Well, I got some good advice actually when I started out, because I didn't go to university. So I was, I think in the ad industry probably, and I hope it's not as true now. I think it probably still is to a degree, but back then, I think, you know, a lot of people went to university. So my aspiration when I joined the industry was within a 3-year period, I had to get ahead of where those university graduates were coming out. Yeah, so they would be working for me. And then that would have proven kind of to myself that whilst there's many great things in it, is one of my regrets not having gone to uni. It would have proven that actually I've put the last 3 years to good use because I've got ahead of where they're coming out. So really the advice to myself was, you know, do it quicker and better than anyone else. You know, everything and anything you did. And the thing that I latterly found, I mean, that was what I was kind of advice I was given when I was going in, but the advice that looking back retrospectively and get involved in new business. The new business for me is really the catalyst of all the great things that happen within an agency, whether that's people coming together, the best work that the agency does, you know, the best thinking. There's tension, absolutely, but I think it gives you great exposure to the broader sense of the business and senior people. So, you know, those two pieces, do it quicker and better than anyone else and get involved in new business would be the advice I'd give to anyone, let alone myself.
So you're a global CEO of Waymaker. I'm always curious about that, the global CEO roles. I know that, you know, agencies have these sort of broad structures, but yeah, what does a typical day look like for a global CEO?
I don't know if there is a typical day, which is probably why I enjoy it so much. I think ultimately you could chunk it down into broadly three areas. So there's clients, new and existing, so prospective clients and existing clients. There's teams and people, you know, your direct team, and then obviously the broader network of the people that we work with and your peers. And then I would say there's the kind of management direction and strategy of the network and the business. So, you know, the finances, the commercial components, making sure that the vision of where you're trying to get to is right, making sure that everyone buys into that vision, you know, being consistent. It's you know, I often compare it to, you know, being a politician. You've got to be on message all the time to ensure that, you know, there's 7,000 people in Wavemaker, 36,000 people in Group M and 100,000 people in WPP. And so if your messaging isn't absolutely spot on, the kind of way that gets disseminated extrapolates out and can be very confused and misguided. So we have to be very, very on message. So it's about clients, new and existing. It's about teams and people. And it's about, you know, direction and strategy for the organization. Those are broadly the three. And then somewhere in between that, I shoe in stuff like this. And, you know, we met in Cannes, for example. So, you know, we had a big program event in Cannes. But, you know, for the most part, I think it's you know, our clients. If we do great work for our clients, then the network will invariably take care of itself.
And so one of the more obvious changes that's happened at WPP has been the very top leadership. You know, well, feel free to speak about the sorrel days if you want, but I'm sort of interested to talk about Mark Reed as a leader and what type of man he is. I was at a WPP event. It was the opening of a new office, and I sort of met Mark for the first time, and we only spoke very briefly, but, you know, he also spoke at the event. I was sort of I think I'd imagined a sort of Machiavellian character who'd sort of engineered the end of Sorrel and had taken over. But I felt like what I saw was a very kind, gentle, empathetic type of leader, like a kind of very much a, you know, what people would often say they're looking for in a modern leader.
You've answered the question, haven't you?
Yeah.
I think you've nailed it, really. I think that's absolutely what he's like. I think empathetic is the word that I would use. I think he's absolutely kind. I think the other aspect I would say, he's super smart. He's, you know, he's a real intellect. And I think what you see in the way that he leads is a team that is, or a business that is simplified, a team that's collegiate and collaborative. And the organization is much more integrated. So, yeah, I don't know that, and this isn't to belittle what he's done, because I think he's done some really incredibly smart things, but I think they're things that a lot of leaders would have done. I think it says a little bit more about how dysfunctional we were previously. You know, he's got a great operational board around him, which is represented from the business. So the key leaders of each of the agencies work with him to drive and lead the business and the transformation that we're going through. So, you know, obviously, that makes enormous sense. He's integrated some of the more legacy businesses with digitally first businesses. So, again, that's brought together the best of both worlds, which makes, again, enormous sense. And I think he's very comfortable in his own skin. You know, I don't think he feels the need to be this Machiavellian kind of old school. I would say he's a very modern leader. And, I'd be surprised if you found anyone who didn't enjoy working for him. I certainly do. Mm.
And obviously one of the sort of challenges that, you know, we're all facing is the prospect of this cost of living crisis, energy bills, and possibly, well, quite likely, in the UK at least, the prospect of a recession. How are clients responding? Are they getting nervous yet? Are they pulling back on budgets? Or, you know, are you seeing those sort of, you know, Unilever and P&G often come out at times like this and sort of say, you know, we're going to sort of continue investing, and we see recessions as an opportunity to build our brand. What do you see? Yeah.
Well, I certainly think that last point's absolutely true. I think if you can, and not everyone can, admittedly, but if you've got the scale and the depth and breadth of resources to be able to invest through a recession, you're undoubtedly going to come, it's proven, you're undoubtedly going to come out of the recession a stronger business versus your peer set. I think, look, ultimately, I think where we're at the moment is a little bit watch and see. I don't want to talk us into a recession, but I think from a practicality perspective, when you see inflation at the levels they are, and particularly driven by utilities, what's going to happen, I suspect, is that as we all have to use those utilities, energy suppliers more in the back quarter of 2022, we'll see the impact of that in Q1 and Q2 of 2023. So we'll see people tightening their ancillary expenditures elsewhere, and that's where I think we'll see challenges moving forward. I mean, we did a dipstick of 30 of our largest clients. 50% weren't at the time, it's about a month ago. So, you know, we're in a fluid environment at the moment, but 50 of them weren't planning to make any changes to their marketing budgets. 25% roughly were undecided. And then 25% were looking at making some cuts. But the interesting thing, Vincent, is none of them, there wasn't any consistency. So it wasn't like, well, CPG are doing this, or tech suppliers are doing this, or, you know, auto's doing this. It was a very, very mixed bag. And I think predominantly based on, you know, what's their supply chain like? Can they get the chips that they need? Have they got the ability to, you know, move their product around or move the raw ingredients in? So, you know, there are some challenges for many businesses out there. You know, one client I know who's in the food sector, they've increased one of their core products by 30% from January the 1st through to the middle of the year, and consumers are continuing to pay for it. So there are certain brands that will, you know, be able to raise their prices and still have their sales come to the fore. There are others who won't. So I think we have to look and see what happens. I certainly think the challenges around the energy supplies are an issue. And I think, you know, people are, you know, currently hoarding gas supplies and pushing the prices up. So I think, you know, we'll see that manifest how seriously time will tell.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird one as well, where you've got, you know, I think record employment in the UK, and yet the economy is sort of stagnating in some ways and falling behind others. But you sort of still think people probably have money in their pockets and lots of employment opportunities. We're not seeing, you know, I know we have seen a few some rounds of layoffs in our industry, but, you know, a lot of people will argue that that was sort of tech companies who needed to trim a bit of fat anyway.
Well, I think, look, the only thing I'd say that, I mean, we can be very London-centric, can't we? Because that's where we are. That's what we look around and see. Whereas, you know, I think there are some bigger cost of living challenges. I mean, yes, London, but, you know, London's still very busy. People are still out. Whereas, you know, outside of London, I think some of those challenges and beyond, you know, we run a global network. And, you know, some of the challenges facing Germany, you know, the US, I hope will be less impacted due to the raw resources that they have as a country. But, you know, where you're shipping in your energy and your gas supplies, you know, you are going to be impacted. So, you know, it's going to be an issue. And it's not just that, you know, it's, again, you know, who knew that Ukraine were the third largest suppliers of wheat to the world? You know, we all know that now due to the crisis going on over there, the war going on. So, you know, there are some big underlying challenges that we need to navigate through as a, you know, not as an industry necessarily, but as a country, and make sure those macro economic challenges are managed accordingly.
But broadly speaking, you know, just again trying to stay on an optimistic track, but, you know, agencies have been seeing growth, you know, at a time when, you know, a lot of tech companies and the platforms are seeing particularly disappointing results. What's driving that for you guys at WPP? I mean, what's driving that growth and the sort of positive results? And feel free to talk about whether you take any pleasure in seeing those results happening at a time when maybe the tech companies are struggling a bit.
No, not necessarily. Look, I think there was a lot of talk, wasn't there, a couple of years ago about whether, you know, our industry was in terminal or, you know, cyclical decline. I think what we've shown is that if you get your business, if you get your house in order, there's a huge demand for what we do. You know, whether that's Coca-Cola consolidating all their marketing expenditure into WPP, or Danone into Wavemaker, or Audible into Wavemaker, you know, two of our big global wins this year, there's an absolute demand for what we do. But what we have to do is we have to be better at articulating how we drive growth for our clients, how we deliver outcomes, and how we ensure that we continue to do that ongoing. And I think there's certain challenges around some tech vendors. I think some are absolutely trying to do what's right for the world in the broader sense. You know, I think Google are absolutely on that journey. I think others are less inclined to do that. And I think others are, you know, I heard one stat, like something along the lines that Meta's advertising has increased by 30% every year for the last 4 or 5 years. So by default, if something's cheap, it doesn't necessarily mean it's effective. And so I think, you know, what clients are coming to us for is that objectivity about how to best invest, how to best grow their business. And, you know, you need to have that objectivity. You know, everyone talks about joint business plans with tech vendors, but you know, they make money from most effectively selling advertising space, and that means not giving it to the degree that an agency or a client necessarily likes. So I think a client needs that objectivity, and I think we help supply that. And therefore, you know, I don't think it's a business that will ever go out of fashion as long as brands exist in a competitive environment. So I think that's why you're seeing us and the industry at large posting, you know, organic revenue growth of, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11%. You know, it's a strong industry, and with amazing people and tech and talent throughout it.
And sort of on the whole, would you say that, you know, programmatic tech has been, you know, a net positive for agencies? I was speaking to somebody recently who he was on the sell side. I won't name him, but he sort of, his belief was that, you know, that programmatic essentially existed in order for agencies to make more money, which I think was probably a little bit too pessimistic. But would you think that on the whole, it's been, yeah, a net positive for the agencies?
Yeah, I think so, because anything that systematizes, you know, codifies what we do and makes it more simple to execute is a good thing, right? Because you don't have to continually change how you go to market. But I mean, I don't know who the person you're referring to is. I mean, if by make more money you can be more efficient, absolutely. But I don't think we'd necessarily hide behind that. I think we can be more efficient, although it is still an incredibly analog at times way of doing things, and I think we can get better, and we can bring a much more automation to what we do around programmatic. But I think the measurement of programmatic and the targeting of programmatic has got to be a good thing for our business. And it's not just, you know, programmatic is just a way of a technology of going to market, but, you know, if you think about the likes of Netflix and connected TV and our ability to use those platforms in a programmatic fashion, as much as outdoor that's digitized, you know, it's a positive way of the market evolving in line with the technology that's available. So yeah, I mean, I think the clients benefit, as I say, because it's much more attributable to outcomes.
Yeah, I think what he was getting at was the you know, arbitraging of media and the creation of sort of agency products, something which I say, you know, in saying that, I think that used to have to be said in a way that, as if it was a dirty word or...
I think some clients benefit from us as a group using our volume to buy media ahead of individual clients, and some clients want outcome-led solutions. You know, some clients really do want that response-generating activity, and I think, you know, for certain clients, not every client, but for certain clients, those types of models work particularly well.
Yeah. I think as well, something that we've seen the CTV market, I mean, the likes of Finecast, particularly in the early days, there was real value to aggregating, you know, these relatively small pockets of inventory. You know, I'm talking about a few years ago in Europe when, you know, things were very small. There was a strong case for aggregating it all, you know, providing some consistency across it in terms of measurement and comparison and productizing that. I think, you know, it was very much a sort of a net good for the industry. So what's the greatest challenge, do you think, for agencies when it comes to video and CTV? What do you think the main challenge is?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that at the moment, there's not a client in the world that isn't looking at what they're doing and how they're doing it, their business, and thinking about the transformation that they're going through. And invariably, the transformation is underpinned by, we've now got lots of data. whether or not that's first party data, second party data, or third party data. We've got lots of data. What do we do with that data to make our business more effective? And how do we feed it back into the broader dynamic of our organization to grow our business? So that gets you to a point of then, well, if you've got lots of data, surely you can talk to your consumers in a much more targeted way, either existing consumers to sell them more products or new consumers to bring them into your business. And I think that's where, you know, data-driven segments, data-driven targeting comes to the fore. And that's, you know, you execute that through the platforms that you've just mentioned, you know, whether that's connected TV or the likes of Finecast, you know, a product that we have, or Xaxis or Inca if you're looking influencer marketing. The challenge is twofold as I see it. One is, if you've got data-driven segments, you need content to reflect those data-driven segments. So you need tailored, addressable content to reflect each of your individual segments. And I'm not talking about hundreds and hundreds of pieces of content, but I am talking about reflecting the consumers that you're targeting through the data that you've had made available. So how you do that, you know, we've got a very strong addressable practice that I think is really driving a lot of growth for Wavemaker because it's a client demand. I think you've seen we've got some creative talent come across in the group, Vin and Harris based in New York. And so I think we're really moving into that space. I think, you know, the industry as a whole could be faster to drive content that reflects, as I say, those data-driven segments. So I think creativity is one area. I think the second one is outcomes, because I think if you get that flywheel of growth between data-driven segments, addressable content, executing addressable platforms, you should start to see outcome-driven marketing flourish. And I think auditors and consultants are much more able and comfortable to reward and to work with clients based on media pricing. And I think nowadays we should really be looking at what the outcomes that we can deliver are, and we should take a share in that success. And that's really, we're looking at products, a Wavemaker that has that kind of holy trinity of data-driven segments, addressable content, addressable platforms, and looking at how we can drive outcomes. And for me, that shift from how cheap is it to what's the value, what's the effectiveness, I think is something that we really need to get to as an industry very quickly.
Yeah, the addressable, I mean, the creative side as well. I mean, there's been various things of, you know, dynamic creative and that kind of thing. But I think, you know, I'll just give you an example. This morning, I was listening to Manchester United podcast For My Sins. I'm a United fan.
Vincent. We were getting on so well.
Who? What's your team?
Liverpool.
Oh my god. Well, okay. I don't know. Are you? You don't. It's not exactly a strong Scouse accent, so I won't feel too guilty about my being a Dubliner.
Exactly. A child of the 80s, what can I do?
Exactly. You were the glory hunter. I was the person who preceded the team with a bit of heart in the 80s. But anyway, they sort of had a, you know, this is obviously a great time for Sky to be getting Manchester United fans back subscribing after, you know, quite a few of us would have cancelled their Sky over the last few years. But they had a tailored ad. It was in, you know, the Mancunian accent, talking specifically about, you know, things that you might want to see United do this year, just at the perfect time when United fans are starting to get excited about the fact that they are above Liverpool in the table again. but it really did strike me as, wow, that was actually, you know, that seems like, you know, even though it wasn't that great an ad, it was very impactful in terms of the timing, the relevance, the way it was delivered. And I feel like that creative bit is a bit that the wheels seem to come off, that you don't often see ads that feel tailored to you.
Yeah.
That's kind of obvious example. But, you know, I've heard frustrations from people within agencies over the years that, you know, they sort of say often, maybe it's just perceived as being, you know, too complicated, too expensive by the client, where they're often be like, well, look, no, we've got this out, we're pushing this out all across Europe, and we've no interest in tailoring an ad for Swindon. Or it can also be, you know, things like, you know, we could do this amazing, cool, interactive stuff on TV. And then when the client finds out, you know, what it costs, and then they sort of see the scale at which they can deliver it, they kind of think, oh, let's just stick with our 30-second pre-roll.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like it might well be worth the effort to actually go that extra mile and make that custom creative.
I think the build on that would be, and what we're seeing is a lot of our competition have got, you know, ID graphs and data sets, but what they don't have is that depth of occasion that allows you to tailor content. So a lot of the work that we're doing with Danone is around occasions-based marketing, and then that allows you to be very tailored on the occasion, which then gives actually the creative quite a good brief. You know, so it's not this person drinks, you know, X amount of Alpro, it's this person drinks Alpro, but they have it for breakfast. Whereas this person drinks Alpro, but they have it in the evening. So you start to have very different messaging that you can communicate. I think that helps creativity. I also think that the big area that, you know, untapped, I would say, and what may resonate more with clients is around how they do their shopper marketing and their retail marketing. So again, you know, if you can get a tailored geography, and Sky did this very well with one of their campaigns about, you know, what you've just described, but if you can do it around retail outlets and embed a specific geography to drive sales, then that might be when clients start going, well, actually, it is worth it, because if I ring fence this area with this message, because these people in this area are vegetarian or not vegetarian, and therefore they are interested in Alpro or not Alpro, then I think you'll see a disproportionate uplift in sales. And then I think you can start to talk more broadly about addressability and about how clients should be using creativity and content to drive sales.
Yeah, I think retail media actually might as well. The type of data that retail media is going to sort of bring into the market might also help. Okay, so final question. Everyone who comes on gets 10 million to invest in a single company or a sector or a football team. It's not allowed to be WPP. Liverpool look like they need it, so for free to spend on a player.
I don't know that 10 million gets you very much now when you look at the prices of football. We might get about 3 weeks' salary. Right, so go on, 10 million. What do I have to do with it?
You can invest it in a single company. It could be a sector that you're interested in, or you could buy Harry Maguire as well.
I would cheat. I'm going to give you a couple of answers. I would cheat, and I would say the sector would be my clients. There's a few good. For example, Colgate, 14 consecutive quarters of growth. So there's a safe and long-term bet, I would say, something like Colgate. You know, you think about their penetration globally, the most penetrated brand, household brand globally. I think they've got something like 60-odd% penetration in Latin America, for example. So more penetrated than any other brand in the world. So I think that's a safe bet. Then I think brands that are bridging the kind of legacy to new economy world, I think longer term will thrive. So, you know, you think about brands like L'Oreal, what they've done, you know, 100-year-old brand, what they're doing with their augmented reality. I think that's super smart. And the likes of Paramount, Amazon and Audible, I think, are all good investments. So that's one thing. If I wasn't doing my clients, and I did actually ask a mate of mine, he knows infinitely more about this type of thing. And he said to me, I wouldn't at the moment do anything unless it was for the long term. And the only long term things he's investing in are solar energy. So there you go. That's an interesting one. So as a sector, solar energy, long-term and wind-powered energy is where someone who knows infinitely more about this kind of stuff than I do would invest. So
it sounds to make sense. There's no safe place. Even the traditional hedges in the stock market, like gold, or I mean, crypto was pretending they were a hedge as well, but doesn't seem like that's very true. But yeah, I mean, gold doesn't seem to be going anywhere amongst all this madness, and it doesn't seem like there's any safe place for savings at the moment. So
cash.
Yeah, just take the hit of inflation.
Well, as interest rates go up, you know, I mean, there's worse things to do than have a bit of cash in the bank if you can find a decent interest rate. But, you know, like anything, it's balancing your portfolio, isn't it, across multiple touch points, property, shares, stocks, whatever.
Yeah, it does seem like the more conservative investment opportunities seem to be coming back into fashion. And there's something I like about that. I was never a massive fan of this thing of projecting into the future that companies were going to take over the world and giving them massive results, where we've seen with the likes of Uber, where you know, getting to profitability seems to be next to impossible for them. And
I think it'll be interesting. I have this debate with a colleague of mine, Crystal, about we've got, you know, Google does search, Meta does social, Amazon does commerce, who does metaverse? Are there multiple metaverses? Does there become one metaverse? If you look at what's happened with, you know, kind of search, etc., I would say there becomes one, but which one and how does it consolidate in, you know, we're talking years, 10, however yeah. many now, but, you know, if you could back that one, you'd probably do quite well.
Yeah, well, I think Meta are certainly making that play. Whether regulators will want them to control reality, and whether I think they'll have the sort of runway with their existing products, it looks like they're going to be sort of reined in by regulators in terms of making additional acquisitions in the social space. So will they have the money to last until it becomes enters mainstream adoption, or would a crash and burn end up being sold in a fire sale to somebody else? And then, it's a very difficult one. I'm a big believer in VR. I'm quite excited about it. I've sort of, you know, was bought a lot of this sort of early VR devices, but my personal experience has, and the experience of many people, seems to be that you sort of try it for 10 minutes, think, oh, wow, this is amazing. Take it off after 10 minutes because you're a bit bored, you've had enough, and then you don't really pick it up again for 6 months. So they have to kind of overcome that, but they might well.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is what tends to happen, it tends to be generational, doesn't it? So for something that we, you know, may pick up and play with and put down, someone else will grow up with and be integrated into from day dot. So that's why I say I don't think it's any time necessarily today, tomorrow.
Yeah,
but as that becomes part of their, you know, part of their DNA, part of their culture, then that's when it gets critical mass, and that's equally when you probably see people being able to use it most effectively in communications because they've grown up with it, and it's just a natural way for them to behave.
Yeah, I do believe we will get there eventually. I just feel like it's just a bit too early to be massively excited about what's happening today. You can't take your eye off it either, though, you know.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. No, look, it's a super interesting area. And I think the combination of the physical and the digital, if you can have a reason to play, then I think, you know, I'd recommend it to clients, but not doing it for the sake of doing it, but combining that physical and digital component.
Super. Well, Toby, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Vincent, I enjoyed it, bar the Liverpool conversation. Oh, yeah. It's very depressing.
You're in a very depressing place. I can understand that. Last season, you would have enjoyed that conversation.
We'll come good. Let's chat at the end of the season and see where we go.
Yeah, maybe not. Okay, all right. Look, take it easy. Thanks again.
Appreciate it.